Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Art of Film Funding. I am your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, the author of the book, The Art of Film Funding, and founder and president of From the Heart Productions. She is also the host of this show, and our guest, Tom Malloy, is a true example of the Hollywood hyphenate. He is an actor, producer, writer. He is a member of the Writers Guild and has sold 11 of his 15 scripts, a great achievement. Tom wrote, produced, and acted in The Addict, The Alphabet Killer, and Love and Dancing. He also produced a documentary called The Inner Way and is now producing another feature. Carol, I hear Tom's new book, Bankroll 2, is a big hit.
Oh, absolutely. And this is a great opportunity for all of us today to learn what's happening, because Tom is a producer who's out there on the street every day talking to investors. So he really has the pulse of the film industry.
Yes, he sure does. Well, Tom, Carol, Dean, and I have found that your second book of Bankroll 2 to have so much new information on financing films today. We're so glad that you joined us today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we see also that that the films today are budgeted for around $100 million or under $100 million. Is this pretty accurate?
Well, what you mean the big studio release films?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically, you know, that was the main reason as far as Bankroll, the second edition, writing that second edition was because the change in budgets, you know, and which is a big thing. And you know, this void that I've talked about for a while now, with you got movies that are over $100 million that make money, and then you got movies that are under a million that make money. And that void was not as big, you know, maybe 5 years ago. It was, you know, you could make a movie $6, $7 million and make profit on it. And now it's very, very tough. And you know, I don't know. There's many reasons why. One of the main being the banking crisis of September 08. But things just fell off a cliff. So you either have to make the over $100 million, which I don't do, or you have to make the million and under, which I've done many of, you know, and then that's kind of where the industry's at.
Well, yes. And, you know, with your experience in all of this, I would take that information to heart. You also mention in your book where you talk about the future of the film business. Now, that is, you say that this now is the time to make a film for $500,000 that looks like $6 million and make a profit. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the key is that, you know, if you made $500,000 film, say, 5-6 years ago, it would look like kind of a glorified student film. And now, you know, you have to make movies in that range to make money. So the key is you don't make the same type of film. You make film that for $500,000 that looks like, you know, $6 million film. You know, I made a film a couple of years ago that was $7 million. Like, I could make that exact same movie today for under a million. And, you know, the key being as well that a lot, there's not as many projects out there. There's not as much money out there. And somebody could look at that from the outside and say, you know, oh, well, that's really negative. And I looked at it and said, well, there's an opportunity here to make a film for that much where nobody looks and says, you know, oh, this is a low-budget film. I mean, I always want to stress, I'm not talking about making yet another version of Paranormal Activity that, you know, was made for $15,000 and looks like it's made for $15,000. You know, I'm talking about a film that you're making, say, $500,000 that no one could tell what the budget is. It looks like any other independent film. Looks like Winter's Bone. Looks like Frozen River. You know, looks like these movies that where you talk about the film. You don't talk about the budget. And then if you can do that, and it's quite possible with the right producers and the right attachments, then you can be successful.
Well, this right attachment is the main thing. You've also spoken in some of the seminars you've given about actors being really anxious to work, and with a fewer films being made, particularly independents, less television work, that they would be more open to a smaller salary. Is that still true?
For sure. You know, and I stress that in the book, that there's a couple of secrets that I kind of live by, and they're not really secrets, but there's a couple the things that I would say stack the deck in your favor as far as getting those big attachments, and one being it has to be a killer script. It really has to be a script that is it makes, you know, it's not one of these things where somebody reads it and goes, oh, yeah, that's cute. You know, it's something where somebody reads it and goes, oh, my God, I have to do this movie. And if you have a killer script like that, it's going to attract talent because, you know, being an actor myself, I know that actors go, you know, insane for a great script and want to find a way to do it. And one of the other little secrets that I have is, you know, I'm a huge fan of shooting in Los Angeles because they're all here. You know, I have two kids. I don't like to leave my kids, you know, and I can imagine, you know, I'm just a teeny bit of a star, but imagine, you know, a big star, you're asking that person, him or her, to work for, you know, relatively nothing. They don't mind driving from Studio City to Burbank to do, you know, 2 weeks on a great script for nothing. But they're going to mind, you know, flying to Detroit and staying there for a month, you know, so, and they're not going to do it for nothing. So that's another secret. I'd say two things to stack the deck in your favor are to obviously have a killer script no matter where you're shooting. And I still really push, you know, shooting in an area like Los Angeles, and I'd say second best would be New York City, third best Louisiana, where you can get talent and they don't mind coming there. So.
Right. Sounds good. Well, what are you working on, Tom? I hear you just came back from India.
Yes, I just came back from Mumbai. I was out there for 10 days. I did, I think, 12 media interviews, including Bloomberg TV India. I spoke at two of the largest film schools, actually the largest film school, Whistling Woods, and another called the Digital Academy. And I was on a panel. I was out there with the producing partner, Brian Ronald, so I did this last film with called Sprawl, which is still being edited right now. And, you know, we held a networking event. We went to a Bollywood premiere, met many of the Bollywood directors. And so, you know, and what we were looking at there is we were meeting investors to potentially get some foreign financing to do films here in the United States. But it kind of organically turned into this synergy thing with Bollywood because I got to tell you, they're making Bollywood movies for so long were kind of stylized, you know, with these big tense numbers and craziness. And they're not just making those movies. They're making legitimately great movies with some great actors. And we met a lot of these actors that are huge, huge stars over there. And they were excited about the prospect of working in Hollywood. I mean, you know, they were definitely interested in being in one of our films. So the goal would be, you know, to get the financing and make some films here, but bring some Bollywood stars over so that we could, you know, have that Indian audience behind us because we have their famous stars in our movie.
Tom, we have a caller who would like to ask a question. I'll bring them on with you.
Sure.
Hello, caller. Thanks for phoning in. We are live here on The Art of Film Funding with Tom and Carol. Please let us know your name and where you're calling from and ask your question.
Hi, Tom. It's Carol Joyce from Los Angeles. How are you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. So right now I'm working with my a filmmaker of mine that I'm working with, and he is insistent that he wants to make this film that we're doing and not get pre-distribution now and take it straight to Sundance and sell it there. And my argument with him is that I can't get branding unless I get distribution first. How realistic is he going to be able to make more money selling his film at Sundance than working on the distribution, getting some distribution now?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would be against the whole Sundance thing, and here's why. I mean, years ago, there's a lot of kind of factors that he's not contemplating. Years ago, just to be able to take a film to Sundance, you know, and first off, you have to be accepted first, you know, and that's going to be, I mean, I think the deadline is October, so you have a long window here before you have to get, and then you have to find out if you got in and all that. So that's one factor that actually becomes a gigantic factor. You know, there's thousands of films submitted to Sundance. But the second part of that is, say they got in and you're premiering at Sundance. Years ago, there would be many, many acquisitions people in those screening rooms, and they'd make a deal and you'd get into a bidding war and it'd be fantastic. That kind of climate is gone and really may only happen for one, maybe two films. So the odds of everything that he's talking about are slim to none. You know, first you got to get it, which that alone is like a 1% chance, and then you have to be that film. And I would say that's like a 1 out of 30, you know, chance to get that. So the odds aren't smart there. I would say, you know, choose the other route of, you know, setting up a screening in Los Angeles, bringing all the acquisitions people that you can, bringing friends and family, and really having a great screening there and see what kind of offers you can get. You can get a distributor that way. But, you know, another thing to remember, Sundance still is – Sundance is not a market. You know, it's AFM in November is a market, and that's one that I would highly suggest you go to. Berlin in February is a market. Cannes in May is a market. So Sundance is not a market per se, and the days of the Sundance bidding war are just long gone.
My notes show that 10,000 applied in 2011, 118 were accepted films, and 38, they say, got distribution. What kind of distribution or how much money they made, we're not sure of. So that's 38 films out of 10,000. That's really not a good number.
Exactly. I mean, what I don't know, have a calculator to do that percentage, but that's whatever it is. It's pretty low. So you know, that's a long shot. You know, I think you're much safer off doing, you know, going to distributors right away, going directly to them, or going to, you know, a market. You know, especially American film market in Santa Monica in November.
And so, what do you take to go to sell your film, Tom? Do you take a trailer?
You're talking about in the American film market?
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, you take the whole film. If the whole film is completed, you'd go there, you know, and you'd meet with these distributors. You know, the key with the AFM, this is getting more specific now, but the AFM, the first half of the AFM is, you know, for those of you who are, I mean, I guess, listening and don't know what the American film market is, let me just briefly describe that. What it is all these distributors and foreign sales agents go to the Loews Santa Monica and the Marigold Hotel both in Santa Monica and take over a room with their material. So you have a company like New Films International that I've done business with for years, and they take over a room and they put their posters up and they have a television monitor running trailers for all their movies. And buyers from all over the world come. And, you know, say buyers from Japan will walk into that booth, that hotel room, and the person from the foreign sales company will sell them on their movie and sell Japan here. And so they have a slate of films that they're bringing to the market. So backing up, I would say that it would be great to contact some of those distributors now so that you can get on their slate of films so that you're being sold right away. But if there's not time for that, as far as the kind of film goes, then you go to the second kind of half of the market where the sales are kind of dying down, and now the distributors and foreign sales are looking to the next market, which is Berlin, and they're looking to acquire films. So that's when you go in, pitch your project, show, you know, a trailer, and then, you know, hopefully they'll screen the whole DVD of the film, and then you can sell that way.
Well, I just want to thank CJ for calling in, Carol Joyce, and we do have another caller that would like to ask a question. So here we go. Hello,
hi.
Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi.
You are on with Tom and Carol.
Well, thanks. My name is Richard, and I'm in Hollywood, so I'm interested in films and making films. And I was wondering, in Bankroll Tool, you talk about a 10% pair play offer, and I think before you had to put the full fee. Is this good?
Well, you know, the key with pair play is that so much has changed about it. You know, that 10% pair play offer that I talked about in the book is just, you know, one example of trying to entice agents into, you know, getting their actor. You know, a quick background is that the pay or play offer is that, you know, you say $100,000 for this A-list actor, you know, and then if you don't make the movie or you don't raise the funds and the movie doesn't happen, they still get the $100,000. And I'm just using $100,000 as a blanket number, just the easy math. But bottom line is, That happened because years ago, you know, I would call CAA and say, I'd like Nick Cage to, you know, be in this film. And they'd send the script to Nick Cage, and he'd say, yeah, I love it. I'd give him, you know, a letter of intent. And then, you know, I would take that letter of intent, try to raise money, and I'd be unsuccessful. And then Nick Cage would call his agents and say, what happened with that movie? And they'd say, oh, it fell apart. Sooner or later, the agent would get fired. So the big agencies did these things where the only offers they would see were pay or play. Now, as stated in, you know, and that was kind of, that description alone is what I said in the original bankroll. But now, since things have gotten so bad, that's not true anymore. And offers are just offers, and it's kind of back to the old way. They won't just give out letters of intent, but, you know, it's a lot easier to get, you know, actors and cast, especially with a good script. So when I talk about the fair play, now it becomes a power thing. If you can make a fair play offer, do it, and they're going to take you so much more serious. You know, they're going to go, wow, this person is legitimate, this movie's legitimate, and whether it's 10%, like I talked about in the book, or a full pay or play offer, it just, all it does these days, it's not required as it was maybe 5 years ago, but what it is it makes you a much stronger, you know, puts you in a much stronger position with the agent or manager to get that actor.
Oh, great, thank you. That's good to know.
Thanks so much for calling in, Richard. Well, you know, Tom, it looks like you're pretty popular. We have another caller that would like to ask a question, but I just want to give Carol a chance to respond first in case she has anything that she wants to ask you in what you just shared.
Well, Karki Kessler has got something in my new book, The Art of Film Funding, talking about a no-pay or play where it's sort of like a tax-free situation. You can get a letter from an artist saying their intent is to be in your film, and then you can legally use their name to go raise money. Have you tried that one yet?
Well, you know, that's similar to at the end of the day, you're trying to get that letter of intent. You're trying to get it to say that I've got, you know, Jessica Biel attached to my movie. So, you know, it's whatever method it takes. What he's doing, it's not that it sounds fishy, but I mean, it's another way of to me, that's the same thing as calling and just saying, can I get a letter of intent from this actor? You know, it's you're just kind of putting up the facade of a pay or play. You know, the only thing I can say is that you had a real pay or play for real money, where you can show it in escrow, or you don't even need to be in escrow, just have a signed contract saying this is a pay-or-play deal, you are going to be in such a much better and stronger position these days, because they're not out there anymore. I mean, there's so few projects getting funded. If I call Agent A and say, hey, listen, I'd like, you know, Christian Slater, I got this money in escrow, or I got this money as a pay-or-play deal, they're going to return your phone call, and they're going to be really excited about it.
Oh, that's good to know. Great, thanks.
All right. Well, we'll bring our next caller on. Thank you for calling in. You are on with Tom and Carol. Go ahead with your question, please. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Oops,
they may
like
have
trying.
They may have a little trouble with the reception. We do have another caller as well that's holding on. So, Hello, caller. Thanks so much for calling in. And we'd like to invite you to ask your question. Let us know your name and where you're calling from as well.
My name's Karen from Arkansas. And I just had a question about the 5% finder's fee people usually give to people to help them find money in movies.
Okay. Was your question specific to that, or?
Is it legal? I think Karen wants to know.
Oh, is it legal? Well, I see. Okay, got it. Look, here's the key with the finder's fee, because I remember, you know, there was some type of legal loopholes as far as giving a finder's fee to somebody as far as finding money for your film. But let me back up just so that everybody that's listening knows what we're talking about, is that you're talking about, let's use round numbers again, so you want to raise $1 million for your movie, and you reach out to somebody and say, look, find me someone that has $1 million, and I'll give you a 5% finder's fee, which equates to $50,000, and I'll give you an associate producer credit or co-producer credit or whatever. I discuss it in the book about the legal loophole as far as finders go, and then what I say is this, and here's my reaction that I discuss in the book, is that, you know, I can hire anybody to be a producer on my film. You know, there's no rules about who I can hire and who I can't hire. And if I wanted to hire Carol Dean to be an associate producer of my film and pay her $50,000, I could do that. And that's one of the keys to doing this right. You know, if I'm talking about it to Carol and I say, hey, listen, do you have anybody that has money? And she brings me somebody that has $1 million, you know, I think that not only is it, you know, I mean, it's right to hire her as an associate producer to the film. So that's really the way to kind of handle that is to say, okay, I mean, you know, you want to work, you're bringing value to this company, theoretically, and if you're bringing value to this company, you'll be working for this company. So that's really it. At the end of the day, it's placing that person and giving them a title instead of saying that they're a finder and they're getting a finder's fee, where there's some, and you could, if you want to just do it that way, there is a way that you can do it, I think, up to like one time per LLC. I know that you mentioned Corky Kessler, he's an attorney in Chicago. He talks about it. And there is, you could do it one time, but like I said, I stay away from that and say that, you know, I would like to hire. I can hire whoever I want, and I'm hiring that person to be a co-producer, an associate producer, and they're getting a fee for that service. And that's really the way I handle it.
That sounds good. That sounds nice and clean. And I know it's been a way that they've used in Hollywood for years. And I think that documentary filmmakers should offer that fee to find money, because it's a legal thing to pay someone to do a job for you, and that is a job, believe me. But
exactly. You know it's work, right? Yeah,
it is work. Not kidding. We just did a funding party, and the guy who was giving the party said, "Now, Carol, you make the first ask, and you have to get $5,000 because I won't take another donation, a lower donation, for my documentary until you get the $5,000. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? So I made an offer that the person, whatever person put in the $5,000, could have the same title I have, which is associate producer. And a generous woman raised her hand. And I thought, thank God, we're off and running. And it was the beginning of a very successful funding party. But you have to have the other person's needs in mind when you are asking for money, right, Tom?
Of course. You know, the key is you want to create a situation where you feel like you're giving more value than the money that you're asking for. And that's a huge thing, and that'll be in any business. I mean, I remember hearing this years and years ago, maybe 20 years ago, in an Anthony Robbins tape. Like, you know, how do you get what you want? You got to ask. And then how do you ask? You give more value than what you're asking for. And, you know, so then that's kind of a bigger picture kind of thing. But the key is when anytime I'm asking for money, I feel like I'm letting that person in on an exciting investment that's going to be incredible. And it's going to be this incredible ride, especially nowadays when I really feel that I know what's going on as far as the market goes. And I know that I can deliver a really great movie and deliver it for a price that's, you know, a fraction of what it used to be. So.
This was what I wanted to ask you, was what do you say to potential investors? How do you, when you meet them, do you pitch them immediately, or do you get to know who they are first and then pitch them? And then I want you to go into some of the things you include in your pitch, please.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, it all depends on how kind of the meeting was set up, really. You know, if I know that I'm going there to pitch an investor, I want to make sure that he knows that I'm going there, you know, to do that, or she knows. I never want anybody to be blindsided, you know, that I'm, you know, hey, just meet Tom Malloy, and then suddenly I've got a presentation for them, you know. I don't want to do that. I want them to know exactly why I'm there and what it's for, you know. But there's a couple questions there, and one is, you know, as far as qualifying the investor beforehand and doing the research, I do that, you know. I do research beforehand, and I do research there. I just did an article for a blog, I think, called Filmmaking Stuff, and it's about 5 tips to qualify your investor if they're real. I think it's on the Facebook fan site. But basically, the key is that I say there's things that you do before you go. You Google that person. You do do some research that way. Then you qualify the person that when you see them, you know, what are they wearing? What are they even driving? And I know it sounds superficial, but you know it's there's exceptions to the rule always, but obviously there are certain things that will tip you off to whether this guy or gal is a high-net-worth individual. But the way I start every meeting is I start asking questions about them. You know, where are you from? You know, and that's for twofold. One is to try to catch a common ground. You know, they say, oh, well, I grew up, you know, I was teaching ballroom dancing or something, and then they go, oh my God, I teach ballroom dancing, and then bang, you've hit on this common ground, you know, whatever that may be. And I know a lot of information about a lot of random subjects, which is good, you know, and So you can hit on that, you can talk about that subject, but then as well, so that the first is to establish a common ground, but the second is to qualify, like, who they are and where they're from, you know, and asking them questions, and then they say, you know, well, yeah, I just bought this business over in China and this and that, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, okay, so this guy's real, you know, versus then it's happened the other way, whereas I've started a meeting, I joke in my seminars about how many times I've, you know, realized in seconds that this meeting was going to go nowhere, and one of the worst times was a six-hour drive from Los Angeles to Scottsdale, Arizona, and to meet with an investor, and in 30 seconds, I went, this guy is nobody. I just had to finish the lunch and know that I had to drive 6 hours back.
Oh,
you know, it's horrible. It's horrible, but, you know, there's the worst, but that's just one of the times that, you know, stuff happens. It's the way you got to do it.
We have about 4.5 minutes left. We have one more caller, and then
sure.
We have one very special closing question for you as well. So let me go ahead and get this caller. And you are on with Tom. Please let us know your name, where you're calling from, and ask your question. Go ahead, caller. Area code 501. All right. Okay, we might be having a little... sometimes that happens.
They're nervous. They're nervous now.
Well, we do have a very special question for you. Carol, I know you wanted to ask us about how to do a closing.
Yes, I do. Thank you so much. First of all, I just want to go back to what you were saying, Tom, and that was brilliant. I can take notes. I'll re-listen to this program and take notes because you're spot on. You have to be prepared, and you have to feel confident in what you're saying, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And then the next thing is, how do you close them? Because so often people will say to you, oh, it's a great idea, I'm thinking about it, so call me in a couple of weeks. And do you call?
Well, yeah, no, you know, I'd hate to hear that, by the way. And I what I'd say is that I would be, personally, I would be avoiding that prior to that so that they wouldn't get to that point. Because if they said that, that's probably not going to happen as far as the investment goes. The key to closing is always to be leading to the actual close. It's always to be walking them down that path to the path where they're going to close. And it's asking some of the hard questions. Okay, so what's the next step? You know, that's something that I will throw out all the time. You know, if I know it's not going to close at that meeting, which on the first meeting it probably is not, what's the next step? What do we do? When do we meet again? You know, and then I have the follow-up. Okay, so you want to meet Tuesday. And not say, we'll meet, you know, another next month, I'll give you a call. No. It's like, okay, well, I'm here. And, you know, I mean, I'll take Indy as an example. You know, I'm here until next Thursday. Okay, so why don't we meet Monday? You know, and following up and pushing that person so that they have to commit. And it's not just some random, you know, one day, well, let's talk in the future sometime. It's pushing them down that path to, when is this going to happen? Because if they are real, they're going to have to get to that place where they're going to close, and you got to get them there.
So your job is always be closing.
Yep, ABC, always be closing, and always be, you know, you have it in your mind of when that's going to happen and have a finite date as to when that's going to happen. You know, it's like, I want to close this by this date. I want to get something on paper. And, again, don't be afraid to ask the hard questions. When can we go to contract? When can we sign? Those kind of things, and put them out there.
Right. And, well, tell me, what was the easiest film you ever closed, the easiest ask that you got?
Wow, that's I would say none of them are easy. I would just say that, and I actually put that in the 5 tips that it's too easy. That's a red flag because it's probably a scam artist at that point. So I would say that they're all hard. You know, nobody was easy, but the one that I most was, if you stack the deck so much in your favor where you're giving the most value, that happened one time, and that seemed to be the one that closed the quickest, but not the easiest. Nothing's easy.
The one that you had that you gave the most value, and they saw the value.
Exactly, and and the value translated to them, and they said, okay. And, I mean, that was like it was a $1.5 million close, and from day one to day, you know, I think it was four. So one to four, that was, you know, it was two meetings in that time, and on day four, the money was in our account.
Tom, you are a wealth of information. We thank you so much for all of the good that you're sharing with your new book, Bankroll 2.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Yes. Okay. And Carol and I want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com and watch for future shows. I beg your pardon?
Let's give Tom's website, too.
Oh, yes, Tom, please share your website.
Great. Well, the book is called bankrollthebook.com. You can buy the books directly from the website. I don't actually, let me say that I think the second edition is not up there yet. You're going to have to buy that on Amazon. And, you know, and as far as people consulting with me, that website is f3film.com.
Excellent. Well, we want to thank you for listening, everyone, and tune in again. We'll have Jill Spitzmiller and also Bill Woolery joining us in future episodes. Good luck with your films.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Take care.